ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from the Bhagavad, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 49, and this will be text number 12. The purport is on number 13, but since the 12 is on the board, we will do 12, which I haven't looked at yet. So we can run through the Sanskrit words first. Na,
na
anyat,
anyat
tava,
tava
pada ambuja pachyami
sharanam
nirnam
vibhyatam
mrityu
samsarat
ishvarasya apavargikat nanyatava padamboja pashyami sharanam nirnam vibhyatam mrityu samsarat ishvarasya apavargikat nanyatava padamboja pashyami sharanam nirnam vibhyatam mrityu samsaran ishvarasya apavargikat nanyatava padambojat pashyami sharanam nirnam vibhyatam mrityu samsaran ishvarasya pavargikat. Yeah, please. Again. Ishvarasya Bhagikat
Nanyatava Padamboja
Nanyatava Padamboja
Vashyami Sharanam
Vrijam
Vibhyatam Mrityu Samsarad
Vibhyatam Mrityu Samsarad
Ishvarasya
Bhagikat. Anyone else, ladies, like to try it? Nanyat tava padam bojat Pashyami sharanam nirnam Vibhyatam mrityu samsarad Ishvarasya pavargikat. The name of this chapter is Akura's Mission in Hastinapur. Word meanings: na,
na
no,
no,
anyat,
other,
tava,
your,
pada ambuja, then the lotus feet,
pashyami,
I see,
sharanam,
shelter,
nirnam,
for men,
vibhyatam,
fearful,
mrityu,
of death,
samsarat,
and rebirth,
ishvarasya,
of the Supreme Personality of Godhead,
apavargikat,
which give liberation. Translation. For persons fearful of death and rebirth, I see no shelter other than your liberating lotus feet, for you are the Supreme Lord. Now, this is Queen Kunti speaking, and I'll go into a little bit of the background in a few moments, just after I finish the next verse, which does have a purport. Namaha Krishnaya Sudayaha Brahmane Paramatmane Yogeshvaraya Yogaya Dvammaham Sharanam Gatam. Translation. I offer my obeisances unto you, Krishna, the Supreme Pure, the Absolute Truth, and the Supersoul, the Lord of pure devotional service, and the source of all knowledge. I have come to you for shelter. Purport. Srila Sridhar Swami has translated the word yogaya as unto Krishna, the source of knowledge. The word yoga indicates connection and also the means to achieve something. As conscious souls, we have a connection with the Supreme Soul through bhakti or devotion. Through that relationship, we experience perfect knowledge of the Supreme Soul. Since the Supreme Soul is the Absolute Truth, perfect knowledge of him means perfect knowledge of everything. As stated in the Mundaka Upanishad 1.3, Kasmin Bhagavo Vigyate Sarvam Idam Vigyatam Bhavati. When the Absolute is understood, everything is understood. Thus, Lord Krishna himself, by his spiritual potency, establishes our connection with him. And that connection is the source of all spiritual knowledge. Thus, Acharya Sridhara, by his thoughtful translation, stimulates us to deeper understanding of Krishna conscious philosophy. Om Agina Timanandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshud Unmalitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge, and I offer my humble obeisances unto his lotus feet. So here we have Akrura, who, at the order of Krishna, has come to visit the Pandavas and also to give Krishna, who sent him, a report as to what is going on in Hastinapur. Krishna, of course, knows that the Pandavas and Kunti are being ill-treated in the sense that the five Pandavas, right now they're children at this point in the story. Not little children, but you might say, just it's hard to say, it's around teen or just below teens. Based upon the translations going before this, where Kunti mentions that my sons are constantly being harassed by Duryodhana and Dushasana and those brothers, all sons of Dhritarashtra. So Akrura, who is the uncle of Krishna, who is a brother of Kunti, and I believe they have the same father, Shurasena. And Akura is considered a very advanced soul, very advanced devotee. And he's known for his perfection in praying. As we know, when he was ordered by Kamsa, going back many chapters, to go to Vrindavan, although externally he played the part of one who is sympathetic to and approving of Kamsa, which was nothing more than a political ruse, simply to give Kamsa the assurance that he would do a job for him that Kamsa wanted, which was to invite Krishna and Balaram for a special sacrifice and also for a wrestling match. And at the wrestling match, the plan was that Krishna and Balaram would be killed when they entered the precincts of the arena. And if the elephant Kuvalayapita didn't kill them, then he had a batch of wrestlers whom he was almost certain would kill those boys. But little did he understand the depth, the power, the greatness, the grandeur of Krishna and Balaram. Of course, Krishna had merely made mincemeat, so to speak, of Kuvalayapita, and played with him, and then he just battered him and killed him. So that was the one, and then came Mushtika and Sharana and a batch of other wrestlers who at least thought they could wrestle with Krishna and Balaram, and since they were young, much younger than him, and they looked quite delicate because actually they were only 11 years old, but they looked 15 years old. They always looked a little older than what they were, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And so they asked Krishna and Balaram, you know, would they fight in the wrestling ring? And Krishna, just an ordinary child, says, well, I don't think that would be fair because look at you, you're so big, you're so powerful, you're so mighty, and we're just a little bunch of, just two kids. He says, oh, we know your reputation. Don't try to fool us. We know that you will give us a good run for our money, so to speak. Krishna, he says, no, I don't think so. You know, he's playing a very humble, very modest position. No, I don't think so. He says, yes, come on, Krishna. We know you. Don't fool with us. You can fool them in Vrindavan, he said. But we heard all about what you did with Agasura and then the Vatsasura and all those other Asuras and Putana Witch and then Trinarvata. We heard what you did, he said. So come on and give us a good wrestling match. Of course, they themselves were a little bit scared, but then Kamsa had ordered them that you have to fight them and kill them. So otherwise, Kamsa would have killed them. So killed not Krishna and Balaram, but the wrestlers. So anyway, they did get into the ring, and then we know how that came out, one after another, Krishna and Balaram, in short time just finished them off, and that was that. And finally, the climax was that Krishna, when he saw that the cowherd boyfriends were being harassed by Kamsa, who was very angry. He was telling all the band or the musicians to stop playing after Krishna killed Mushtika and Shanara and the others. He's telling them because it was a big victory, a lot of music, triumph, and he said, shut up, all of you. I don't want to hear that. You know. So then when Krishna saw that he was and there was a lot of applause, and so he was shutting everybody down. So Krishna got up, and of course, and he challenged Kamsa, and there was a fight, and then some of the other Puranas besides the Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavat Purana, they fight and fight, and they fight in the air, they fight on the ground. It's quite longer than it is in the Bhagavat Purana, and finally, as we know, Krishna kills him. So that gives some idea of Krishna's power, his ability. And Kunti, who is a very advanced soul, here she is. Her husband has fairly recently died as a result of a curse that he had received sometime in the past, that if he had sexual relations with any of his any of his wives, he would die immediately. And if he had gone on for a number of years, probably about 11 or 12 years, living as a complete celibate, and finally one day when he was with his wife Madri, and it was the springtime and the breezes were blowing and the birds were chirping and the butterflies were flipping their little wings, and everything was, at least the ambiance was so delectable, so delightful, so attractive, and the fragrances of all the new flowers were there. And so he yielded. He couldn't help himself, and finally he died. Then Kunti and I'm just giving a little background to this. So then Kunti and Madri, it had to be decided what would happen. Kunti wanted to ascend the funeral pyre, and Madri also wanted to ascend the funeral pyre, because they, in those days, they were so deeply in love. Their love was all based upon the idea that their husband was the Lord, and they were serving their Lord as with their whole heart and soul. And wherever he would go, they wanted to go. So it was decided amongst the two. First, Kunti wanted to. She said, "I'm older, and so I should be the one to enter the fire." They call it the Sati rite. And Madri says, "Yes, you're older, that's true, but you know how to manage the children better than I do. In fact, my two children, they regard you just as much as a mother as your children do. So, but your children don't regard me as much as a mother as my children do. It means that you have some very special ability to comfort them and to protect them and to guide them and to love them. You're manifesting." And of course that was true. Kunti was an advanced spiritual soul, and she had met many holy men during the time when she was growing up in Kunti Bhoj's palace, who was like a stepfather. And it was finally decided that Madri would leave, and then Kunti, she would take the responsibility of all of the five children, Yudhishthir, and then Bhima, and Arjun, and Nakula, and Sahadev. And so that's exactly what happened. And after Pandu died, and the funeral pyre was then lit, he was cremated, and Madri was with him. Then Kunti left with a group of holy men and traveled back. They were living in the forest at that time as a result of the curse. What happened was that Pandu decided that he would live like an ascetic, and he did so very, very well. The ascetics were very much pleased by his character, by his behavior, by his asceticism. So anyway, Kunti took the five boys, and they trekked back up to Hastinapur, and there they were. Let me give a little bit of the background of King Dhritarashtra, because it's very important to understand. Dhritarashtra presently is the king. Now, at birth, when he was born, it was declared and decided very firmly that he could not be the king because he was blind. He could not really be a king because why? Well, he couldn't defend the kingdom. That's one thing. When you're blind, you can't defend. You can't see. You can't make plans. You can't make strategies. You can't develop tactics. You can't do any of those things. So in terms of maintaining the kingdom and developing the kingdom, bringing in new lands, bringing in new monies, new wealth, he was not capable of doing any of that. But Pandu, who was the second son, was capable. And he was therefore named the king. And he was the king up until the point, as I said, when he was cursed, at which time, since the kingdom had to have a king, Pandu said to his servants there, since Dhritarashtra wasn't where he was up in a forest retreat, and he said to these servants there, "You tell my brother that he should be the king until my sons grow up and they are of age and they can Yudhishthir would become the next king. But until then, he should rule under the guidance of who? Anybody know? Who would he? How could he rule? He didn't have any sight. He would rule under the guidance of Bhishma Dev, who was one of the greatest statesmen in the world at that time, and also probably the greatest warrior in the world at that time, in spite of Dronacharya. He was trained by Parashuram. So he had gotten the best training, and not only that, but he even had a battle with Parashuram, and he was about to defeat him. He had gotten a special mantra in which Mother Ganga appeared and pleaded with him not to use it and to please make friends with his guru and stop. And he said, well, you tell him to stop fighting and I'll stop fighting. And then Parashuram said, no, you tell him to stop fighting and I'll stop fighting. And then it kept going back and forth. And so she said, will you both stop acting like children and stop fighting? You're grown men. You're the greatest warriors in the world. Can we just leave it at that? There's a whole story why the fight took place. It had to do over Amba. Parashuram wanted Bhishmadev to marry Amba because he had touched her at some point in the past. No one would marry her. So on behalf of her, he tried to get Bhishma to marry her. But Bhishma said, Allah, you know I've taken a vow of complete celibacy that I will not marry. And that was the way my father got to marry Satyavati. Otherwise, her father would not allow her to be married to my father. What's his name? Shanti, the father of Bhishmadev. Shantanu. Yes. Yes, Maharaj Shantanu. Anyway, so it would have made his father look like a liar if Bhishma yielded to Parashuram in that particular incident. Anyway, they parted as friends, and in spite of the fact that Bhishmadev had gotten a mantra which would have been able to kill Parashuram, still at the end of the fight, he offered his obeisances to him, to Parashuram, and Parashuram hugged him. And it's amazing the love that was there and the admiration that Parashuram had for his student, Bhishmadev. So I just want to give a little of the background of that. Anyway, Kunti is now on the way. She gets back to Hastinapur, and Dhritarashtra is the ruler. So he will rule under the guidance, as I just said, under Bhishmadev, and also under Vidura and a few other counselors. In other words, he's basically a figurehead. Nonetheless, his will, whatever he declares, whatever he states, that is the law. Because he is the king, and he was given due initiation into the kingship. But it was supposed to be what you call a pro tem king. A pro tem is a temporary king, so that when the actual regent, which would be Yudhishthir, would come of age, he would have a certain amount of knowledge, he would have experience, and he would have the moral fiber, the moral development, he would have the maturity, he could then rule. But at this point in time, he's only about 11, 12 years old. He's not qualified to do that at that time. So Kunti is here with her children, and the Kauravas, and the 101 sons, actually it's really 100 sons that envy the Pandavas, the one of them which came from one of Dhritarashtra's sons, his name escapes me, but that one son who was born from a Vaishya wife, he actually admires the Pandavas and he glorifies them and honors them and he informs them like a spy of all the activities that Duryodhana has planned, such as the poisoning, the second poisoning that was planned for Bhima. So here we have Kunti, she's lamenting. You see, she's talking about how her sons are being mistreated, how she's being treated like a stranger, how alienated she feels. And she's asking about her relatives and her friends. And, of course, her relative, Kunti, Kunti's, I'm trying to remember, she's the aunt of Krishna. I mean, that's the physical aspect of it. But she sees Krishna above and beyond being her nephew. She sees Krishna as he is, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She's a very advanced soul. Nonetheless, she's a mother. And as a mother, she's very concerned about her children because she knows that Duryodhana wants very much to kill Yudhisthira, to kill Bhima, to kill Arjuna, to kill them all. Why? So that he can become the king. And actually, Dhritarashtra, Although he does have some moral, he has moral training. He was raised by Bhishma Dev and Vidura. He knows what's right from wrong. Nonetheless, because he is a weak-minded person, rather spineless, in fact, and because he knows he could not really be the long-lasting king, he could only be a king for a certain amount of time, then that would mean that he would have to give up his position, and his son, Duryodhana, could never become the king. Now, it just so happens to be that Dhritarashtra is very much attached to his position as the king. He loves that position, and he loves it because he knows that it's possible, if all the Pandavas could be killed, that his son could then carry on the position that he presently has legally, but he really is maintaining it and continues to maintain it for the next several years, in a manner which is actually unbefitting. Even when Yudhishthira was, when he got older, when he was approximately 16, 17 years old, he still did not yield the kingdom to Yudhishthira. He did make a ceremony promising that he would become the next king, but everything was done to prevent that. And the way it was done is the Pandavas, as we all know, was sent to... I forgot the name of the town, but it was only about Varnavrata. Yes, thank you, Prabhu. He was sent to Varnavrata to live in a mansion, live in a big house. So it came out in the assembly. Look, you boys have been fighting, and you've been developing the kingdom. You've been acquiring so much wealth for the kingdom. You must be tired by now. You've gone from kingdom to kingdom to kingdom, and we all know how much you deserve a nice, peaceful vacation. Yeah, very peaceful. So he sent Duryodhana. They made a plan that the Pandavas would be burned to death, including their mother. And that comes later on in the story, that they would be burned to death, and then it would be a clear coast for Duryodhana to assume the throne. Just see the madness, the attachment to power, to fame, to glory. And Dhritarashtra, he knows that he's blind, and of course Pandu gave him all of his wealth. He treated him nicely. How could you do this to a person who treats you nicely, who gives you the kingdom, and what do? You want to kill his sons. Is that kindness? Is that the way a brother should act to another brother who's given you wealth and given you a power, given you a kingdom, given you all these things, and this is how you pay your debt. This is how you pay your respect, your honor to your brother. I mean, you could just see the weakness, the spinelessness of Dhritarashtra. And we find out as the pages move forward, even when Akrura tells them that you're not treating these sons of Pandu fairly, you're treating your own sons with more affection, with more kindness, with more love, and you're not enabling or helping these sons to feel that they have a father. Of course, Bhishma Dev does take good care of them, and so does Vidura, and so do a number of other persons in the kingdom. But Dhritarashtra was the what we call the head honcho or the king. The king should be showing that type of warmth. But because he was blind, he felt in one sense, and so did Duryodhana feel in that same sense, that he had been denied being the king just because his father was blind. And he felt that he was being mistreated or treated unfairly. And actually, he wasn't being treated unfairly because your father is blind. That was his karma. And therefore, Pandu was not blind, and Pandu could fight, and Pandu did develop the lands, maintained the kingdom, and acquired many different properties and much wealth. And therefore, his son deserves to be the next king. That's the legal situation. But it's one thing to be the legal situation, but it's quite another matter to emotionally accept that. I mean, intellectually, you can accept it. You can say, "Well, yes, that's the way the system works." Nonetheless, the desire for power and pleasure, especially Duryodhana, he convinced his father over and over again. He would say, if the Pandavas become, if Yudhishthira becomes the next king, with backed up by the Pandavas, what is going to happen is that we will be made into servants. We will be made there like their slaves. They will remember all the difficulties and problems and pressures we put upon them, and they will get back. They will avenge themselves for everything that we did. So it's necessary to kill them. So eventually, as we know, as I mentioned, they are sent to... they're sent to, can you give me the name of that place again? Varnavrata. Yes, they were sent about 60 miles away north of Hastinapur, along the Ganga. So that's what then the attempt was made to kill them, but it failed. And that's a whole story in itself of how the Pandavas escape and how Vidura helps them to escape and so forth and so on. So here we have, now we... I advanced the time forward, so we're coming back to the time now where the Pandavas are around 11 years old, and Kunti is feeling very helpless because what has happened, and we learned this a few pages previous, that an attempt was made on the life of Bhima. The feeling of Duryodhana and his brothers was that if they somehow could kill Bhima, who was the most powerful, then they can easily kill the other Pandavas. But get Bhima out of the way because he was the protective force. So that was what happened. What happened was that Duryodhana invited the Pandavas to an outing, and they went to this. They went to this outing in. This was in a different area. I forgot the name of that place. So he was. They were invited to this outing, and what had happened was that a big home was built for sporting areas. So they would go out there, and they would have wrestling matches in the water, and they would play and have fun. So Duryodhana approached in a very friendly way, as if he was trying to make all good. Everything was fine, but in his heart of hearts, he had only one intention, that was to kill Bhima. So he got this poison... And they had a big banquet there in this new home. And in the banquet that was there, what Duryodhana did, he went into the kitchen and he took the poison and he mixed it into the rice that Bhima would eat, and it was fully mixed. And then what happened was that, and it wouldn't take place, it would not take or result immediately, but after a few hours it would kick in and then Bhima would die. That was the plan. So Bhima did take the big feast, lots of rice with lots of poison. And a little bit later on, when it was getting near sundown, what happened was that Bhima became very sleepy. Duryodhana saw that it was kicking in, and he acted as if he was sleepy also. And the Pandavas and also the Kurus, they all went into the that guest or rest house that they had there, and they went to sleep. Bhima and Duryodhana, they were just taking a little temporary rest on the beach there. And when Duryodhana saw, when he saw that Bhima was fast asleep, and then he tapped him, and then he shook him, and he wasn't waking up, he was under the impression that he was almost dead. There was maybe just a little bit of breath coming out. So what he did is to make sure that he died is he dragged him into the Ganges River and swam out with him and then pushed him, his head down under, and then from all intents and purposes, he appeared to die. So that was the impression that was given. I mean, after all, you put him underwater, what else can happen? He's got poison in him. He's got water in him. Can he live? But little did he know that the Pandavas, who were sons of demigods and who were highly virtuous, they had the mercy of the Supreme Lord upon them. And what happened is Bhima was, he was teleported to actually another planet, one of the lower planetary systems. which is, I'm trying to remember that planet name, Atala. Anyway, one of them, it's called, it's a snake, the Naga, one of the Naga Lokas. And he's transported there into some cavern, and he's fast asleep there. And then the Nagas, they're actually snakes, but they have human-like intelligence. And they see him, and they're on guard duty in this big cavern, because in the back, Vasuki, their king, happens to be there in his meditation. And what happens is that they consider him a trespasser. Suddenly he appears there. And what is he doing there? They don't know anything about him. So they attack Bhima. Interestingly enough, it's so interesting how Krishna arranges things. They had these fangs, and in these fangs contained very deadly poison. So they began to dig their fangs into the body of Bhima, and as they did that, they released the poison. So when the poison was released, it acted as an antidote to the poison that Duryodhana had given him. So it neutralized that poison, which caused or enabled Bhima to get up and feel his usual strong self. And he began fighting with all the Nagas, and he was just flinging them against the wall. He was a very powerful young man. He was flinging them against the wall here and there, stepping on them and so forth. Anyway, the word got to Vasuki, and Vasuki heard about it. And one of Kunti's great-great-grandfather, he was there. I forget his name. He was there, and then they came out, and they told Bhima, stop fighting. And they introduced themselves, and the great-great-great-grandfather, he introduced himself, and he said, we're your friends, we're sorry that this has happened. And the reason they didn't greet Bhima at the beginning is they wanted to use that poison to neutralize the poison that he had been injected with. So anyway, long story short, Vasuki wants to give Bhima a gift, the gift of the strength of 10,000 elephants. And in order to do that, they have this particular potion that they've made, and they give it to Bhima, and he drinks it, and he goes and sleeps for approximately 7 days and seven nights. And then he gets up, and he's super powerful. He's got the strength of 10,000 elephants. Now, this is, goes... So Bhima now has the strength of 10,000 elephants, and there is nobody, really, none of those Kurus could ever even dare to wrestle with him. If they tried to, nothing had happened. So when they attempted to poison Bhima, they were having wrestling, what they call water wrestling matches. Maybe some of us guys have done this when we were younger. You get on somebody's back, and you try to pull the other person who's on somebody else's back. You pull him this way and that way and try to throw him in the water. So they had these matches one after another, and Bhima came out victorious all the time, as I said. And then it was then after that that the poison kicked in, and so Duryodhana, he brought him and dragged him in and into the he dragged him into the Ganges and so forth. So anyway, he got after he was revived, and then he went into this other planet. He was then transported or teleported back to where he originally was. And he went back to his parents. And although he was very strong, nonetheless, the Kurus continued to try to kill Bhima. They tried again. But this particular potion that he had been given was able to resist poison. So they gave him Duryodhana tried again to kill him. This time, Bhima took all the poison, and absolutely nothing happened. They said, wow, what is going on? How could he? They didn't know that he had gotten this potion, which made him so very, very powerful. So Kunti here is very like a loving and warm and kind-hearted mother. She's so concerned about her children that somehow another attempt will be made to kill them and how to protect them. So she's crying out. She's crying out for the mercy of Krishna, and she's talking to a Kurav who's part of the family. Will Krishna come and visit? Because if he's here, nobody will harm my children. He knows that. So that's a very interesting thing, how Kunti understands that Krishna is the supreme protector. As we know in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, in all activities, just depend upon me and work always under my protection. In such devotional service, be fully conscious of me. If you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the You pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but act through false ego, through the idea that you're the doer, you're important, forgetting me, well, then you will be lost, he said. So he tells Arjuna, as long as you remember me during this battle, that you're going to win this battle. Of course, they're going to win it even if they don't remember him, because Krishna has that. That's his plan. Nonetheless, he's trying to make sure that Arjuna does remember him. And he's also giving instructions to all of us to remember him always. Krishna said, therefore, Arjuna, you should always think of me in the form of Krishna, and at the same time perform your prescribed duty of fighting, with your activities dedicated to me and your mind and intelligence fixed on me, you will come to me without a doubt. So he gives him a promise. If you do your fighting and you also think of me, of course it wasn't that difficult to think. Of course, Arjuna is just going to be discharging thousands and thousands of arrows, but he's got Krishna right in front of him. So peripherally in his vision, he could still see Krishna. But he has to see him as who he really is, not merely a charioteer, which is the part that he volunteered to take at the behest or request of Arjuna. So Krishna continues to emphasize this, engage your mind always in thinking of me, become my devotee, offer obeisances, worship me. Thus completely absorbed in me, surely you will come to me. He's giving a promise. As you surrender unto me, I will reward you accordingly. What is the reward? I will give you myself. And if you have myself, you have everything. As the verse says over here in the purport, that if one meditates upon Krishna, becomes dependent upon Krishna, is absorbed in Krishna, and receives the knowledge from Krishna, then in effect, when one has that knowledge from Krishna, because he is in complete sync, in complete harmony, he's a complete via media of Krishna, then in effect he knows everything, not the way Krishna knows it, but whatever he needs to know, Krishna can give him that knowledge, because Krishna is all knowledgeable. Krishna is omniscient, he's omnipotent. A good example of this, Prabhuji, is that, for example, Yamaraj has a certain degree of omniscience. Now, only Krishna is omniscient. He knows everything. But for the service that Yamaraj, who's the Lord of Death, performs, how is he going to know all the virtues and all the vices of all the persons who come to him so that he knows where to assign them? Should he go to hell? Should he go to a heaven? Where to send them? So Krishna gave Yamaraj a certain amount of omniscience so that he just looks at him and instantly he knows this is a, all his virtues, he knows all the vices that he has performed, and he knows exactly when you put two and two together, he knows exactly where he has to send him. Krishna knows that, so he gave him that. Similarly, the love that Krishna has, tremendous love that he has, for especially for his devotees. The pure devotee is always within the core of my heart, and I'm always in the core of my pure devotee's heart. My devotee does not know anything else but me, and I do not know anything else but him. I envy no one, and I'm partial to no one, but I'm equal to all. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am a friend to him. So Krishna is saying that if you are devoted to him, he will give you more and more of himself. Again, as they surrender, to the degree that they surrender, to the extent that they surrender, I will give them myself accordingly. So Kunti now is begging Akura, and she's asking, does anybody remember me from Mathura? They haven't moved to Dwarka yet. Has anybody in Mathura, do they remember me? Where I am, and that I even exist, that I'm here with my five sons? Akura says, yes, don't worry about it. Krishna has you in mind, and Krishna will protect you. And since you are you depend upon Krishna, just the way Krishna expects his great devotees to depend upon, he will make good his promise. Those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, Krishna says, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack and I preserve what they have. So you're going to be fully protected, but it may be a little difficult because these people, yes, they do hate your children because they want to take the position away. So Kunti was roused to depend upon Krishna. Without that kind of dependence, she could not feel the insulation. She could not feel the inner strength. She could not feel the ability to go on and deal in such a kingdom where you're not really wanted. I mean, think about it. Anyone here who's ever been in an environment where you're not wanted, where nobody really wants to talk to you, or if they do talk to you, it's spurious, it's fake, it's false, it's simply to be diplomatic. It's a horrible feeling, you know, to feel, especially since she's always been loved and liked in the kingdom that she grew up in Kunti Bhosha's kingdom. And when she was earlier, she was, she still knows her father, you know, Shurasena, who's the actual father. Kunti Bhosha, she was given to him because he had no children, and therefore Shurasena made an arrangement with him. Here, you can have my daughter. And so she was raised in a kingdom, and she was properly and nicely educated. So that's the situation there in terms of this particular purport. And let me just see some of the verses. So Akrura and Vidura, they consoled Queen Kunti by reminding her of the extraordinary way her sons had taken birth. So, in other words, they're trying to reassure her. Not only do you have Krishna, of course, who's supreme, but your sons they have the protection of their biological fathers. And who are they? Well, we have Lord Surya. Well, actually, Lord Surya, he helped Karna to come into being. But then we have Dharmaraj. Not only do we have Dharmaraj, but we also have Lord Vayu, who was Bhima's father, and we have, Bhima's father was Lord Vayu, and Dharmaraj was Yudhishthira's father, Arjuna's father was was Indra, the head of the demigods, and then my mind has gotten overheated. The other two sons, can you name them for me? Huh? Nakul and Sahadev, thank you. They're the sons of the, not the four Kumaras, but the Asvini Kumaras. And so they all have powerful fathers, and they're ready to give help and aid to their sons if need be. So they're reminding her, please, you really don't have anything to worry about. Because if Duryodhana makes any attempt to harm them, they are protected and they will in some manner or way get out of the problem. And they do. We know when the house of lack is burned down, Vidura, he warns them, tells them even when it's going to happen, and they escape through the tunnel that they had built. So I want to just conclude this by saying that all of us can learn from Kunti of how to depend upon Krishna. Of course, her sense of helplessness came from the fact that she had, of course, a female body, and she felt weak, and she felt that she could be harmed at any time. But here we have Akrura and Vidura reminding her that not only are your sons protected, but you also have protection from those men who helped you to give birth to your sons. So don't forget your actual situation and try to be more courageous, especially with Krishna as your nephew, and he's well aware of everything. And I'm here, Akrura says, to try to get Dhritarashtra to see things in a proper way, in a clear way, in a balanced way, in a righteous way. Hopefully I can do that, but we all know that although he prevails upon Dhritarashtra, then what does Dhritarashtra say? I accept everything you say. Whatever you say is correct, it's right, it's all true, but look, I'm a victim of my karma. I'm a victim of fate. This is the most weakest, lamest type of excuse for acting like a criminal. You know, I'm a victim of my fate. This is what Kamsa said after the persecutions of Devaki's six sons and killing them, smashing their heads on a concrete or on a stone floor. I'm just a victim of my fate, so please excuse me. I didn't really want to do it, but I was just driven by the gunas, by the ignorance and passion to do it. If I had my way, I never would have done it. This is complete sheer nonsense. And although Vasudev and Devaki could see right through it, nonetheless, because they were saintly persons, because they were saintly, they didn't want to create any more animosity than already existed with Kamsa. They went along with it and they said, yes, we are all victims of our past karma, etc., and so that they would live in a peaceful way. And of course, that was that. They were left alone for a certain amount of time. Are there any questions or comments from any of you here? Do we have internet comments or we don't? But I mean, are we able to know what anybody, anybody is asking, any questions or anything like that? No? You had your hand up, Prabhu. Did you want to ask a question here?
We were talking about Queen Kunti praying for difficulties.
Yeah.
How is that someone would want more difficulties, or at least how could we even relate to somebody wanting more difficulties than we already get?
Yes, that's a nice question. The question is that Queen Kunti, in her prayers, she prays for difficulties. She's actually asking for them because when there were difficulties, she said that when there are difficulties, we think of you, Krishna. This comes much later when she utters those prayers. That's when Krishna has already visited and he's helped the Pandavas in different ways, and he's about ready to leave. That's when those prayers are uttered. And she's referring directly to the time when they were living in the forest. And at that time, she was really in a very helpless situation, actually, just living in the jungle. And so what did they do? You know, there are lions and tigers and panthers and wolves and snakes and all these things. So they always depended upon Krishna at that time. And by depending more and more upon Krishna, she became more and more God-realized and became more blissful, more peaceful. At this time in the book, this is much earlier than that particular time. She's not as advanced here as she was then because she has gone through, at that time, many ordeals, and she has become more and more dependent upon Krishna, and she feels the bliss of Krishna consciousness and the courage that real Krishna consciousness gives. So that definitely pertains. But here, it's a new situation. She's never encountered this. She hasn't adjusted to this new situation. And she can't bear the idea that her sons are being harassed and threatened threatened with death and so forth. When they were in the forest, the only threat there was is, of course, from the animals. Duryodhana didn't know where they were. In fact, he thought that they were dead. He thought that they had died in the house of Lak, because five male bodies and a female body were found there, which were not the Pandavas, but which happened to have been some wanderers who wandered into a banquet that they had on that night of the fire. And they were mistaken for the five Pandavas. They had been burned beyond recognition. So they were thought to be the Pandavas. Therefore, everyone thought that the Pandavas were dead. So Duryodhana, he felt he had nothing to worry about since he was the acting king. He was acting on behalf of his father with his father's permission. So anyway, at that point, Kunti, she's stating that she's come a long way. In fact, she is stating that When you're not around, she says, we just pray like anything. And that prayer brings us close to you. Because when prayer comes from the depths of the heart, Krishna, who is in the heart, not only hears it, but acts upon those prayers and gives the relief, gives the protection, gives the strength to the devotee. I don't know if anyone here has been in a circumstance of great difficulty, but I know I have, and where I had to pray very, very intensely. And in so doing, I felt completely consoled and comforted and relieved, and that I really had nothing to worry about. This is what intense, deep, dependent prayer does. So my understanding, based upon your question, is that Kunti has come quite a way from the time where we are now reading in this book, and she has developed this wonderful dependence that I mentioned from that verse 18:57 and 58. Does that answer your question, I hope? Hmm? Is it clear? Yeah? Oh, okay. Otherwise, Prabhupada would just go on talking until somebody said, yes, it's clear. So if it's clear, thank you. Does anyone else have a question or a comment that you'd like to make? Let me just mention that tomorrow morning I will also be giving the Chaitanya Charitamrita class, a very interesting class on the pastime of Jagai and Madai, and I intend to review it. And what we can learn from that pastime in terms of the infinite mercy of Lord Nityananda, the infinite mercy of Lord Chaitanya, it's a marvelous pastime. How two vicious criminals get turned around into two saintly, loving devotees of God. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. And how Lord Nityananda, how he engineered this whole situation so that he loved Lord Chaitanya so much, and he knew that Lord Chaitanya is God. Of course he does. He himself is God. And he knew, but nobody else in the community there, nobody knew that in Nadia. And he wanted to make Lord Chaitanya famous by this type of a transformation of these rogues, these killers, these rapists. And if Lord Chaitanya could make them into saints, then his fame would go way, 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 way up. And that's what Lord Nityananda wanted to do. He wanted to glorify Lord Chaitanya Krishna. So how he does that is absolutely amazing. And I hope I'll have the opportunity of meeting with you tomorrow morning, when I give that class. Tonight, this afternoon, I am giving a home program. If you want to know where it is, or whether you can go there, if you would see Nityananda Chandra, he knows where it is, he knows the address of it, and I'll be talking there on another Bhagavad Gita verse. When I say another, last night there was a home program that I did, and so forth. So if I'll give one last opportunity, if anyone has a question, or anyone has a comment or anything like that. This is one of the most beautiful temples I have ever seen. It's absolutely stunning. It's mind-blowing. This is where classes should be given. People say, well, did you go to India? I haven't been to India since 1992. Well, when I come to temples like that, what is the difference? You know, these columns that you have, the pictures that you have, the beautiful deities that you have, it's absolutely awesome. It's mind-blowing. I just feel that I'm, you know, with Krishna. And the architecture here, the floor, which is a wooden floor, but it's beautiful, it's polished, it's clean. And the Vyasasana is one of the most beautiful Vyasasanas I've ever seen. It's absolutely gorgeous the way everything is so symmetrically laid out. So it's very easy if you live here and you see it every day to become habituated and acclimated to it, to the extent that we forget the greatness and glory and magnificence of our present surroundings. But if we just stop and to take a look and to realize that Krishna is behind all of this, these beautiful paintings, murals actually, that you have here, I could spend a whole day, if maybe many days, just looking at these paintings. They're awe-inspiring and So please, we should all feel highly appreciative that we have such a temple to come to. I mean, this is apt by far. I mean, I thought we had a beautiful temple in New Dwarka. It is beautiful, but I don't think it can compare, architecturally speaking, with the columns, the way, and this arch, these arches on the ceiling, and the sky effect that you have on the ceiling, and the Garuda over there, and all this is absolutely, I'm charmed and inspired by all of this. I don't even want to get out of here. Maybe I should take my little sleeping mat, put it down here, and get a little extra benefit. Yes, Prabhuji, did we? It's, what is that? Oh, really? Was he involved in the actual establishment of all these, of this whole ambiance that we have? All of that? Well, what a great contribution he made.
Sri Tamal Krishna Goswami was involved in everything and everybody.
Wonderful. Yeah. I knew him quite well, and he used to listen to my narrations. Every time I would be with somebody who would be talking to him on the phone, like I was last time I talked with Tamal Krishna Maharaj, was that on the phone I was with Radhanath Maharaj, and he said, well, I'm right with Amala Bhakta Das. So he wanted to speak with me. So I spoke to him. I said, oh, Maharaj, please get my obeisances, glories to Prabhupada. How are you? How do you feel? He said, that service that you have performed is absolutely, the way he put it, that service you have performed was absolutely amazing. It was actually, I have no words. He would go on and on like that. I said, okay, I got the point. You know, he would say like that. He bought everything, the CC, everything that I had. I remember his assistant, assistant was a sports athlete of some sort. This goes back quite a number of years, 1980s, I think. And he I remember him buying the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Chaitanya Charitamrita. There were big albums then. He went out with a whole, you couldn't see his face because it went up this high, you see. So, yes, he became one of my fans, and I just recently saw Jaya Pataka Maharaj. And so he claimed, he says, I'm getting everything you have. I'm your fan, like that. I says, my fan? I'm your fan. He says, no, we're all each other's fans. We're all Prabhupada's children, all Prabhupada's servants. So that was all nice. And then also so many different persons. So Tamal Krishna was, I always had a very wonderful experience when I was with him. And I can see he had such great intelligence to be able to somehow enable this to happen through Krishna's mercy. He took full advantage of the mercy of Prabhupada and Krishna. So we're all very fortunate, I must say that. We are highly fortunate. This floor, now a lot of temples go for marble. I'd never seen, and this is kind of a parquet type of floor, this type of wood, the way it is. And the way it's been diamond-shaped and is so shiny. What do you wax it every week? It looks beautiful. You almost see your face in it. And I compliment you all and congratulate you all for maintaining such a gorgeous, beautiful temple. I just spoke to two devotees before. They're probably listening on the internet, Chakri and his wife, and they were over in, Phoenix, yes, they were in Phoenix. I last saw them there, and I just saw them here, and they said, oh, they love the temple here, and they're fully engaged in service. And you come to a temple like this, how can you not, you know, love this place? I may sound like I'm exaggerating and going on, but when something deserves to be praised and honored, we should never stop. That's why we always keep talking about Prabhupada, because he deserves to be constantly praised. And in spite of that fact, that as many praises as you have, you still are fully in debt. There's a zillion more to be given. And consequently, you always feel that you haven't given enough, you haven't said enough. And like the Vyas Puja book should be like zillions of pages long. And still, you wouldn't get tired of reading all these praises, because actually Prabhupada deserves more than that. These are just words. But what we really need to be giving is our deeds, our efforts, our perspiration, our dedication, our devotion, our sweat, as I just mentioned. We need to be giving the sense that whatever activity, whatever service, whatever love I give to Srila Prabhupada, I can't give him enough because he sacrificed just everything for me. So how can my little service even compare to the gigantic, august service that he has provided for us, his children? So we really do have a great responsibility and a great debt. We are constantly in arrears. We should never think, well, you know, I did a service and I almost lost my life. I guess that does it for Prabhupada. No, you should have lost a million lives. You're still in debt. You're still in debt. You can't even measure the mercy that he has given. You can't see it because it's not visible to our physical contaminated eyes. But when you see the effects that take place in our lives as we grow, as we develop, as we become purified, as we become more interactive with each other in loving exchanges, as we start to appreciate the sweetness of Krishna and Radha in their deity forms, as we appreciate the sweetness of Krishna in the trees outside, in the leaves, in the flowers, in the clouds, in the sunshine. All of these things are, we appreciate them because Prabhupada has given us the mercy, the eyes to be able to see them in a Krishna conscious manner. So we should be endlessly thankful to Srila Prabhupada. He doesn't have to be your personal guru, but he's everybody's guru in ISKCON. Actually, it's the whole world's guru, whether they acknowledge it or not. That's why we often call him the savior of the whole world. And through the Krishna consciousness movement, through these great books, so many people are being redeemed, and many more will be redeemed. And we have the great opportunity to assist in this process. So whomever we meet, if we get an opportunity, yare deka tare kaha Krishna upadesha mara agyaya guruhana tare edesh. Lord Chaitanya says, whomever you meet, tell him about the pastimes and the philosophy of Krishna. In this way, on my order, become a spiritual master and try to liberate everyone in this world. Okay? Thank you so much. Hare Krishna. Jai. Thank you again. Hare Krishna. Oh, I know you from someplace. You look familiar. You used to live where? In Los Angeles. Yeah, that's why your face looked very familiar. What is